to experiment on them.
Democrats who oppose the bill say tissue from miscarriages and stillbirths often isn't useful in scientific research. That's because tissue hasn't formed yet in early stages of pregnancy. The bill hasn't been voted on yet in committee. Laurel White, Wisconsin Public Radio.
Now a quick check on WGTD sports and weather. NBA, Bucks and Bulls off last night. Tonight, the Bucks host the Detroit Pistons. The Bulls play in Oklahoma City. College basketball, Marquette loses to number 19 Purdue, 86-71. In the NHL, the Blackhawks host the New York Rangers. Forecast now from the National Weather Service, cloudy with some fog and some more rain this morning. Then partly sunny, chance of rain this afternoon, a high of 49. Right now, still raining, wind from the south-southwest at 13, 45 degrees. For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. Coming up on 11 minutes after 8, the morning show with Greg Berg is next. Support for the morning show comes from Jack Andrea, a Kenosha tradition since 1911. A unique shopping experience time and time again, and that's what brings you back. Don't forget about Jack's Cafe, Jack Andrea, 2401 60th Street, online at andreasgifts.com. Support for the morning show also comes from the Carthage College Office of Continuing Studies, providing graduate and accelerated certification programs in education to start or advance a career in teaching. Convenient evening and summer courses are designed for the working adult. More information is available at carthage.edu/grad.
And we welcome you to the Wednesday morning show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. Tomorrow night at 7:30 in Wartburg Auditorium, Carthage College, under the direction of theater professor Martin McClendon, is proud and pleased to present yet another Vet Night of the Arts, designed to help all of us in the community better understand the experience of veterans. An array of different art forms will be represented, and one of the highlights of this year's festival is the presentation of a one-man show called Cry Havoc by Stefan Wolfert, who himself is a veteran and now a highly regarded theatrical producer and director. Yesterday, I had the opportunity to record an interview with Stefan Wolfert to find out more about his life and career and the work which he does with veterans. We experienced a bit of technical difficulty through the course of our conversation. I apologize for that, but I hope you will listen carefully and appreciate what Stefan Wolfert has to say about his important work. We began the interview by having him talk about where he is from originally, his military service, and what ultimately led him into the world of theater.
The story of my work really is my story, essentially. And when I found it, as I shared it, so many veterans are saying, that's my story too. So that's how this grew to be the work that it is now, starting in the early 90s, rather. I'm actually originally from Wisconsin. I'm from La Crosse, and I joined the Army in 86 to kind of get out and see the world and get away and, you know, escape all that stuff, see adventure, what they were advertising on the commercials. My service was nothing of note, especially, you know, with today, with everything that's going on. I was from 86 to 93, so I was in during Panama and Mogadishu and the first Gulf War, but I was usually training up for anything that continued to happen from that. But a friend of mine was killed in training. I'd become an officer the latter part of my 7 years service. And I had one soldier commit suicide, and I had another one get killed in front of me during a training accident. So I had lost it. I mean, now I can say that at the time I wasn't sure what was going on. So traveling around the country on an Amtrak, and I just kind of left, and I had a sergeant who was covering for me because he saw it. He was a Vietnam veteran, so he recognized what was going on with me. He covered me. And I saw Shakespeare's Richard III. And to see a veteran out on stage, because Richard III is, and he's at the top of the play saying to the audience, the war's over, and I don't know where I fit. Now, I didn't have a war, per se, the Cold War, the First Gulf War, that kind of thing, but I could tell my service was over, my military service, and I felt deformed the way Richard talks about it. I felt physically deformed, I felt mentally deformed, And he went on through that play. I had what now today I understand as a catharsis, but at the time, I didn't know what the heck was going on. I was caving, sobbing, trying to choke him back in my mouth because I didn't, you know, the town I grew up in, you don't have public emotions. You stay stoic. So I was having a really massive release of emotion. And within a couple of years, went to grad school for acting to explore that further and found that the Shakespeare work, the Shakespeare's text, and examining this was helping me when I started realizing, oh, I do have PTS. You know, because I thought I couldn't have it. Only Vietnam veterans have that. How could I possibly have it? Well, lo and behold, I start doing the work full-time around 2000, 2001, and then these wars break out, and, you know, we have 9/11 in 2000, and now the need is rising once again. So I've been able to apply this work, merge it up with scientists from NYU, Dr. Alicia Ellie and Bruce Homer at CUNY, to formalize this program to actually start treating PTS in veterans, but through Shakespeare, believe it or not.
We'll talk more about that in just a second. I want to make sure we talk just a little bit further about Cry Havoc, which is the one-man play you're going to be doing Thursday night.
Yeah.
Some of our listeners might recognize the title as coming from Shakespeare's play Julius Caesar. What can one expect to experience if they come see you present Cry Havoc?
Well, my hope and also the feedback I get, you know, it's a 75-minute show, and besides it being a boy from Wisconsin, going out to do this work, I think a friend of mine, Karen Harris, described Cry Havoc the best. She said it makes the suffering of our veterans ancient, and it makes Shakespeare contemporary. And that, you know, while it's not the goal, it does seem to be the effect that these words are like the same thing to Shakespeare. And we realize, wow, how much it's still relevant today, and how unfortunately this is a 400-year-old problem at least. It's actually older, but 400 years ago, Shakespeare's writing about the exact same problems that our veterans and our family of vets have. And from my own story, sharing what are the major obstacles to transitioning, and that's what I hope to share with humor and Shakespeare's style. Usually it's a pretty tough sell. Oh, okay, it's a solo show, so one guy, no set, no costume, no cues, doing Shakespeare and talking about being a vet. Gee, sounds cheery, but it actually is. It goes all over the place. I share all the veteran stories as well.
Let's talk a moment about the work that you do with veterans, leading them in acting workshops, and particularly leading them in performances of Shakespeare plays. I think in something I read, I believe on your in an article about you, you said that this experience touches, in your words, on something we hold uniquely as veterans. We know what we're capable of, and I suppose a veteran potentially can really tap into a very deep pool of experience when it comes to being an actor in some of these great works. What is the biggest challenge in terms of helping some of these veterans to do that?
Well, you hit multiple things there to cover. So what's the biggest challenge? First is that to get over the fact that there's anything quote-unquote wrong, because I'm also not saying by walking into the room with me there's something wrong. You know, there doesn't have to be anything wrong. That's why, you notice I dropped the D from post-traumatic stress disorder, that actual diagnosis is PTSD. I drop it out of respect because it's post-traumatic stress from, unusual incidences and having a usual response or typical response. So getting people in the room and then getting them just to take up time and space, just to be present and be in that space with other people, because that's something that we had together in the military. That's what I mean by uniquely. We get it because we went through that training. What we have is this bond, and this is even coming from veterans who didn't have a particularly camaraderie-based experience, shall we say, whether it's MST or other abuses. They still understand that in the military, we were shown that basically we aren't wired to kill when we're born. But the military has to shape us into soldiers, sailors, airmen, and marines. So they break us down, and the way they do it is by depending on each other. That we need each other, and that camaraderie in every aspect, every moment of our day, is rooted in that camaraderie. He gets that. And he also gets that we're both. So for a number of veterans who, whether they actually were trigger pullers, as I call it, right, actually, you know, infantry, pulling the trigger on target, or drone pilots, or water purification specialists, or supporting the, you know, an invasion or a surge or what have you, it doesn't matter what job, the suicide rate of 22 a day or 20 a day, depending on which stat you look at, goes across all eras, all generations, all military experiences and jobs. So that tells us something. And I would argue that it's being in that machine that's killing, not going to the military by any stretch, but being part of that disconnects us from our humanity. And we have to. The military does it really brilliantly, as a matter of fact. So when I come back out, I'm trying to reconnect them to their own humanity and the humanity of others. And Shakespeare does that brilliantly because what he allows, unlike anyone else I've seen, any other writer, is he allows us to be both. He allows us to be that quote-unquote killer and the us. You know, for me, as the way I talk about this, little boy who wanted to be a dancer from Wisconsin and then went into the infantry. I was an airborne air assault infantry officer. So can I be both? Yes. And Shakespeare gives me actual language that helps me say, no, I'm actually both of these. And then to communalize it. And the next big obstacle, because you asked what one of the biggest obstacles, be in the room. Then when they are in the room, they start sharing the stories. Now to share those stories publicly with other people. Or as Jonathan Shea describes it in his book, Achilles in Vietnam, he talks about communalizing the trauma. The indigenous populations do this as well. The Native American tribes of North America communalize their trauma. It's another place I learned it. So to get in the room with people that are our families, that we don't feel we can normally tell these stories, we can now get in the room together in this other thing known as theater that's safe and where I can speak what I feel and not what I ought to say, as Shakespeare puts it. So those are the obstacles. There's successive obstacles. Now, first, it's just being in the room present, then sharing our stories, then sharing them publicly. But we build that through camaraderie and a creative model.
Is it ever difficult when you are working with veterans, particularly when you are working with them towards the goal of mounting a production, when it comes to the fact that some people are gifted as actors and other people not quite so gifted or not quite so skilled, and you probably have some veterans who have some experience and probably some who are absolute newcomers. I'm guessing that at least to some extent in a situation or setting like this, you are not in pursuit of excellence across the board in the same way that you might otherwise be, or maybe I'm wrong about that, but how do you handle that when you are talking about a situation which is obviously about much more than just as good a finished product as you can possibly produce?
Right. Well, that's the other valuable experience or lesson that I've learned from theater, which is everything is in process. We get where we get, which is antithetical to the military because it's so mission-oriented. It's so binary. Go, no go. Kill, don't kill, right? It's do, don't do. There's only that binary. But the theater allows us this place in the middle, and arts in general do, where it's, no, we get as far as we get today. There is no mission. So some productions, and keep in mind, when I was in Los Angeles is mainly when I did the large productions with vets. Since I've been in L.A., we've broken it down. It was a tool that came from doing whole productions with vets that became the work I call Decrute. But you're right. What I would do is mix civilians in with veterans and not in this thing of, oh, that's a lead, let me give it to a professional actor. Very often, the civilians were the smaller roles supporting veterans in the bigger roles. And what we were trying to do is make it seamless so the audience couldn't tell. And the way to do that is less about trying to make them actors and more about personalizing this text and just doing what the playwright wrote, which is a line of verse at a time, and breathe and go, and breathe and go. It's not, stop treating this like it's holy writ. It's just writing about our experience. And I edit them down too, keep in mind. So I'll edit them down, which is somewhat taboo. I don't always do it, but for our outdoor productions with veterans, I would have them. So I'm just taking this cold, so I can crank them real quick.
Mm-hmm.
But with the productions in Los Angeles, we would have work almost all year on the play before we put it up in the summer. So by the time they got up, this was a second skin for them. They were getting up and sharing, and that's what allowed them to share their experience, was by taking on someone else's story. You know, to share Richard III's nightmare. I'm a murderer, yet I'm not. Fool of thyself, self speak well. Fool, do not flatter. For them to fall into that sort of bipolar moment of waking up from a nightmare, thinking he's a murderer, they have to crawl into their own experience as well. And that's where that magic happens. And that's why it works, because the audience doesn't know. At the end, we had very typically either people saying, I had no idea who was, quote unquote, a professional actor and who's a veteran. And even when they did, they didn't care, because the vets were just being present in that room and not trying to be anything other than what they were, and they were so damn charming that nobody cared. You know, because we had everything from vets with severe traumatic brain injury who can't memorize an entire line of verse. So they would carry scripts. We would get creative. We didn't pretend we were hiding the script, but we'd give them a clipboard. Everyone knew, but again, it's theater, you know? It's not... The audience comes, it's attending, wants to have an experience. So if that experience is watching someone work their way through a Shakespeare monologue in front of an audience, I'll be honest, I think it's more compelling than seeing a polished Hamlet come out and say, to be or not to be.
Absolutely. It sounds like just about as powerful an experience as an audience member could possibly have. And I suspect that people will similarly be moved by what you're going to be doing Thursday night. We want to remind everybody that Thursday night is the second annual Vet Night of the Arts. And it will open with a number of different staged readings. And after intermission, Stephen Walford will be presenting his one-man show, Cry Havoc. And this event is free. However, tickets are required for anybody who wants to attend, so you need to be contacting Carthage right away if you are interested. And actually, for anybody who is able, a $10 suggested cash donation is requested at the door, which is going to be donated to Veterans Outreach of Wisconsin. So if you would like to attend Thursday night, and again, this is not just open to veterans, but open to the entire community, if you want to attend Thursday night, you should go to www.carthage.edu/tickets, and you will be able to secure free tickets there for Thursday night's event, which again begins at 7:30 in Wartburg Auditorium. Stephan Wolfert, I thank you for joining me today on the morning show. I commend you for all of this great work that you are doing on behalf of veterans everywhere, and look forward to having you come to Carthage on Thursday night. Best wishes to you.
Thanks, and to you too, and thanks for covering this, truly.
You are listening to The Morning Show on WGTD HD, your gateway to public radio. I'm Gregory Berg, and now an interview that comes from The Morning Show Archive. I am sure many of you are acquainted with an absolutely riveting memoir out of the Gulf War called Jarhead, which was transformed into an equally riveting film starring Jake Gyllenhaal. The author of Jarhead and that memoir was Anthony Swofford, who has written a novel since then and now a new memoir. A memoir at both different and strikingly similar to that first memoir, a memoir called Hotels, Hospitals, and Jails. In this new memoir, Anthony Swofford is not telling the story of that battlefield of Jarhead, but rather, in a sense, a different sort of battlefield, an emotional and mental battlefield, as he waged, in a sense, a real struggle to try to come to grips with his own father and their very, very difficult, painful relationship. Anthony Swofford's father himself was a veteran of the Vietnam War, bearing all kinds of scars from that conflict and experience, which in turn informed the kind of husband and father that he was. And it was the need for him to come to grips with that, and for Anthony to come to grips with that, and for them to rebuild a relationship that was so incredibly dysfunctional and painful. And along the way, there are other struggles for Anthony Swofford as well. And he writes about all of them with disarming honesty and frankness and insight as well. This new memoir, again, is called Hotels, Hospitals, and Jails. The book is a publication of 12 books, and I am very, very honored to be able to speak with the author, Anthony Swofford. Anthony Swofford, we welcome you to The Morning Show.
Thanks for having me, Greg.
Could you tell me a little bit about how this memoir felt different to write from your first memoir, Jarhead? Because I'm struck by how, in some ways, it sounds like very much the same voice, and yet you are talking about very different things. How different did it feel to write this memoir versus the earlier one?
But it felt quite different. Jarhead being my first book, I spat that one out. I wrote that book in about 8.5 months, 9 months, and I don't think I could write a book that quickly now. That was my first book, and there was some energy and some drive, and I knew that story. And what's different about this new book is that I started it having no idea how it would end. I knew the start point was jumping in this RV with my father on our first trip, and I started writing the book shortly after that trip ended, and I started mining our past. And at that point, I didn't know that there would be two more RV trips, and I didn't really know what my life was going to look like 2.5 years later when I was finishing the book. So in some ways, it was very much a real-time writing of the book. That's not totally true. It's not as though I was in the RV composing. But as I was living the life, I was doing the hard work of pulling it in and having it at the ready when I needed to really narrate it and get it down on the page. And so the practice of writing for this book was a very different practice than with Jarhead.
I want to ask you briefly about the Iowa Writers Workshop. Am I remembering the name of that correctly? I don't want to get it wrong like your father always got it wrong. He called it the Writer's Warehouse, I think.
He did call it the Writer's Warehouse, yeah.
I happen to grow up in Iowa, so I don't want you to misunderstand this question. I love Iowa, and I resent people who misunderstand Iowa's and characterize it in certain ways as just a land of cornfields and so on. That being said, I have to confess that I was sort of amazed at the thought that someone would go to the Iowa Writers Workshop and the books that would result from that would be a book like Jarhead or a book like this one. I mean, hard-hitting, raw, difficult, painful memoirs. When I just imagine the Iowa Writers Workshop in my head, and I'd heard about it before, I just somehow on some stupid level imagine just idyllic books about cornfields, I suppose, ensuing out of that. I mean, it never even dawned on me that at the Iowa Writers Workshop, it would be the real stuff of all kinds of different life stories, including your own.
Yeah, the graduates of the workshop definitely pump out the occasional cornfield book. They're out there. But the great thing about the workshop, well, it's been around since 1935. And American letters of the last century are very much marked by the people who studied there and people who taught there. And it's a multi-variegated place with many voices and many stories coming out of it. I happened to be there in the late 90s, and I was certainly the only of my type at that point. I was this guy who'd been in the Marines, and most of my peers there were, East Coast private school, Ivy College types. And so I was a bit of a fish out of water there, but not really because, I wanted to be a writer. And that's, once you're there, that's really all that matters is your dedication to the craft. When I was there, the great writer Frank Conroy was running the place, and he really loved writers. He cared about teaching, and he wanted to give budding writers a place where they could try anything out and work hard. And his thing was, just you've got to sit in your chair every day for 4 hours and get the work done.
Did you feel self-conscious as the only person of your particular background to be there, or did they do something to make you feel welcome and feel open about sharing what it was that was inside of you?
I was very self-conscious and incredibly so, and didn't really write about the Marine Corps at first, or having been in the Marines. It was the dot-com boom time, and everyone was talking about their buddy who just got a job in the Silicon Valley making $300,000 a year, et cetera, et cetera. And that bled into the workshop, too. That kind of that idea of the riches of the dot-com boom. And so when I started writing about the military, there was definitely some sort of open and not hidden disdain for what I was writing about. And people, some of my peers said, "Oh, what are you writing about this war? No, we're not at war. No one even remembers this war. It was not important." That was some of the reaction, but I think the more nuanced thinkers and the people who were bigger thinkers, and certainly my teachers, saw that I was on top of this gold mine of a subject, which was the military and warfare and the internal landscapes of the people who do that fighting. And that was rare there at the time. After World War II, there were a slew of veteran writers who came through Iowa, and after Vietnam there was a whole slew of veteran writers who came through Iowa, but I was one of the first from the Gulf War.
This book is mostly about you and your father, although it's certainly about other important relationships in your life, including the relationship with your brother Jeff, who unfortunately died of cancer, your relationship with certain women, with your mother, but it's mostly about your efforts to try to rebuild the fractured relationship with your father. At one point in the book, you write, "No one else will write about my father, so I am his writer. And in the act of writing, I hope to become again his loving son." There's a lot wrapped up in those few words, but one of them is in that first sentence. I mean, what a mantle of responsibility to be the only person who will ever sit down and write something significant about your father. Was that at all a hindrance or, in a sense, an intimidating burden to bear, particularly as you wrote about your father in this memoir?
I don't know that it was a hindrance, but it was certainly it certainly got in the way sometimes, and it was in my face. I won't kid anyone. There's some dark stuff in this book, and my father was kind of a dark, haunted guy, and he was especially when I was a kid, he was a man I feared, and then when I was an adult, because of some of his behaviors, he was a man I had trouble respecting, but I needed to understand him, and I understand the world and people best when I'm writing and when I'm writing about them. And he was this massive figure. He was in every room I walked into, and he marked me. People are marked by their fathers, and I'm no different. And I was pushing 40, and we'd begun taking these RV trips together, and my father's ill. And some people would say, "Wait till he passes away, and then write about him." But I felt that wouldn't do anyone any service. And I felt an urgency to write about him, and by writing about him, you know, to understand him, and to hopefully, you know, make it a healing act as well. And I remember writing those words that you quoted. I remember exactly where I was when I wrote them. I was in this little writing shed that I have in upstate New York near our house. And when I wrote those words, I think I finally, whatever was in the way, whatever had been in the way in terms of me being able to write about my father, by writing those words, I got rid of them. And I got rid of those hindrances, those blockages. Mm. And I took on the burden of writing about my father with a new kind of verve and a new kind of clarity.
Ironically, those words appear in the chapter where you are telling us about a bombshell letter. I mean, I mean that in a couple different ways, because you characterize this letter yourself as it was though a bomb went off in your face and left, you know, shredded flesh. It was that painful. Your father had written this over the course of, I think, maybe several years, pouring out a lot of his anger and resentment and frustration and disappointment. And so it's interesting to think about, on the one hand, when he took pen and paper and wrote something, it was venting all this anger. And in the midst of sharing that experience with us of what it felt like to receive this kind of letter from your own father, you're writing about writing in a way that will, you hope, bring the two of you back together again.
Yeah, his letter was explosive. It did. It landed in my mailbox, and I knew what it was. It was heavy enough that I knew exactly what it was. And there's a way in which I've been anticipating this letter for a few years. My brother had received a similar letter at one point with my father, letting him know how displeased he was with him as a son. And I didn't open this letter for a few weeks. I threw it in the top drawer of my desk because I wasn't prepared for it. And then, you know, one night I said, well, okay, here we go. Let's do it. Let's see what the old man says. And, you know, he took me to task, and he had some understandable grievances and some things that were just completely outlandish and ridiculous. And so he, you know, in a way, he wrote me. He chose to write me by writing that letter to me. He wrote a narrative of me. He rendered me in a way that I thought was not really fair. And so then I needed to go in and write him and really, you know, rewrite myself, tell my side of the stories that he tells in that letter. And, you know, my father's a pretty good writer, and he's pretty strong rhetorically. And there's a bit of, you know, prose sword rattling that goes on there from the both of us, which I think it will be fascinating for a reader to see and to experience.
I quite agree, and it's certainly a testament to the power of words, and the power of words when they are wielded well, as he does, and as you wield them actually even better in your memoir. For those of you just joining us, I'm speaking with Anthony Swafford. You may know that name. I suspect you know that name from his very powerful previous memoir, Jarhead, which stems from his experiences in the Gulf War. His newest memoir is called Hotels, Hospitals, and Jails. Your father, as I mentioned earlier, was a Vietnam veteran and came away from that conflict, unfortunately, as so many Vietnam vets did, bearing all kinds of different scars. And that played out certainly in the way kind of husband and father that he was. One thing I find interesting about the way you describe your life growing up with him is that you are careful, I think, in every case to say your father was occasionally abusive, both verbally and physically. But I think every time you mention that, you always use the word occasionally. I wonder how conscious a choice that was. And is it for the reason of pulling back from simply saying he was abusive and maybe painting a picture that you don't want to paint, or a picture that would not be fully fair? Can you just talk about that word occasionally?
Yeah, that's a very careful reading on your part, and it's something that I probably hadn't noticed. I don't think that was deliberate. I think, you know, admitting that was difficult. It was difficult for me to write about. It was difficult to out my father as that kind of a father. And also, I guess, you know, once you open that up, then you know, the fear is the die cast. Will I be that same kind of father one day? Which is, you know, another important aspect of the story is me trying to figure out if I have what it takes to be a father. Because I love my father, but I do not ever want to be the kind of father that he was. In his good moments, in his moments of love and his moments of good fathering, sure, I can learn some things. But there were many other moments where, you know, he was an abusive guy. I guess I do pull back a little bit, and I probably pull back in order, you know, to protect myself more than anything else.
This is as good a moment as any for me to ask you one thing that I really struggled to understand. At one point, you, I believe, are quoting someone else's book, and now I don't have that exact moment in the book in front of me, but you quote a line, and you even, here it is, from Suzuki's Zen Mind, Beginner's Mind, I rewrote thousands of times this quote, a good father is not a good father.
Right. I love that quote, and it's something that I try to think about that every day, in fact. I'm thinking about having it tattooed on my body somewhere. I think that Suzuki quote, the essence of that is that, you know, if you decide that you're a good father, you're going to slip and you're not going to be a good father, and that each day you must become a good father again. That's what it means to me. And that each day I will learn what it means to be a good father. When, you know, today my daughter is 9 months old, and to be a good father this morning, you know, was one thing, and to be a good father tomorrow morning will probably be a different thing. And that's the challenge for me as a father.
Your encounters with your father that we read about in this book, I mean, some of it stems from your very difficult childhood, and we'll leave it to our listeners to read about some of the things your father did, and some of the ways he was abusive, and in some of the ways he was simply inattentive in ways that were really painful to you. By the time the events of this book, the present day events, so to speak, roll around, your father has been diagnosed with something called COPD, chronic obstructive pulmonary disorder. And so this is also the story of your father's precipitous physical decline. And I wonder how significant you think that was in the ultimate reconnection, which does occur to some extent with you and your father, that how much of that had to do with this crushing reality of your father literally losing the ability to breathe. And do you ever wonder about how this time and this reapproachment might have played out differently if your father had remained in robust health?
Yeah, I do. It's definitely, it's the ticking clock of the book. You know, every book needs a ticking clock, and the one here is, you know, will this sick man die? The real life ticking clock for me was like, well, will my father die before we're able to work through this? And the ticking clock in the narrative is the same thing. Is this old guy going to die before his son and he come to some kind of understanding? And it's totally possible that if my father was robust and healthy and had no issues, we never would have gone on these trips, and we would have possibly remained at odds. I have a number of male friends who have fathers who are elderly, and they've never had these conversations. They might have similar problems with their fathers, but their fathers never made the effort to have these deep and difficult conversations. And you know, I have to give my father a lot of credit, because he invited me on that first RV trip, and he's the one who reached out across the cabin in the middle of the night on the first night of driving and said, "Hey, son, let's have a talk. Let's clear the air."
What's so interesting, I think, is that he reaches across the cab, you tell us, and grabs my forearm and says, "Tone, I think we need to get some things out in the open and clear the air. I think you need to get some venom out." And he says that repeatedly. It's such an interesting choice of words. But what you go on to describe is a situation in which your father doesn't seem to really understand what that means. I mean, he doesn't really seem to have much understanding at all of just how deep the venom goes and how much of it is tied up in your father and how he mistreated you. And in a sense, it is this messy, awful can of worms, and he has no idea of what he is potentially opening up. That's one of the most fascinating things to see here.
Yeah, I don't think he knows what he's asking for. You know, when he asks me to get the venom out, which is, my father's choice of words, and it was pretty accurate. And he used it again and again over these different trips, and it's as though, you know, he was asking for something and didn't really know the totality of it, and I understand that. I understand that. Probably when we behave badly, we don't always want to come face to face with the reality of those consequences. And that was my father there. You know, in a way, I think my father would have preferred that on that first trip, when he asked me that I say, "Hey, Dad, you know, I'm beyond it now. It's okay. A, B, C, D, E, F, and G happened, and I'm okay with those things now." But I really wasn't.
Right. You write at one point, "My father did not want to hear what I had to say. He considered the case closed on most of my grievances. The statute of limitations expired." You also write much later in the book, this might even be on I'm pretty sure it must be on another of these RV trips you take together, that your father can't imagine that the rift in our relationship has anything to do with our relationship. He's looking for someone or something to blame. And in this case, as you're struggling through this, money and I are to blame. But in a sense, your father is not really ready to face up to the emotional center of your relationship. And again, it's so interesting to imagine the two of you trying to effect this connection. It really helps us appreciate just how difficult, in fact, that can be.
Yeah, it was very difficult. It was, you know, sometimes it was maddening for me because you know, as you pointed out, my father would ask for something that I don't think he was prepared to completely deal with. And the emotional reality of, you know, what happens when you ask your son to get the venom out, you know, is probably something different than what you were anticipating. And for him, it certainly was. And you know, my grievances with him, they ran deep, but they also, you know, you're just, you know, like Faulkner said, you know, "The past isn't past. It isn't even over yet." And so when I have my grievances with my father, they would, you know, pass through him into his grievances with him, his father, and into his trauma over his mother dying when he was a month old. And there's reverb, and that stuff comes back to me. It's so complex and fascinating, you know, fathers and sons. And for me as a writer, you know, I was sitting on this relationship, which was the you know, the most troubling relationship I'd ever had. I had to write about it. I had to live it, and I also this had to be you know, my next book, trying to figure this man out, and then, you know, simultaneously trying to figure myself out.
Right. One of the things you were angriest about with your father is that he did not come to the funeral of your brother, Jeff, who tragically passed away from cancer. Your brother, Jeff, who was a stupendous athlete and very good to you on many, many levels. And to see him waste away and finally be claimed by cancer was, of course, tremendously painful for you, for your whole family, and for your father, who kept his distance, who stayed away from that funeral. And that's one of the real linchpins to your rupture. I want to ask you about something you write about your brother, Jeff. I should think this was not easy, that in the wake of his death, one of the things that lingered were all of his lies. For all that you admired about your brother, he told all kinds of lies about himself, all kinds of tall tales about, well, this and that, wonderful things he had done or accomplished that, in fact, were not true. I wonder if it was painful and difficult for you to share this part of the story of your brother, Jeff.
Extremely so. As a kid, my brother was my hero, and he was a great brother. He was a lovely, lovely guy, and to write, he was kind of a compulsive liar. He told lies about things he'd done and places he'd been, and when I realized that, and then when I was sitting down working on it and writing about it, it saddened me deeply, because he was a great guy and he didn't need to tell lies about, you know, playing an exhibition game with the San Francisco 49ers, or the list goes on. And I felt, you know, what was sad was thinking that he must have felt like whatever he was doing wasn't good enough, and so he needed to create these alternative stories of who he was, and that saddened me, because I think who he was perfectly fine, and that he should have been happy with who he was, and he should have lived, you know, in his life rather than fabricating these other lives, and that realization was extremely sad.
Absolutely. You write, the man dies, his deeds remain, and so too his lies.
Yeah.
Back to the very beginning of the book, you write, I believed there existed no grander test for a man than combat. Every other pursuit was pure, unimportant leisure when compared to a firefight. I suspect that you maybe do not believe that, at least to the same extent. Do you see other tests of a man that are nearly as powerful as those in combat?
I do. I see fatherhood as now the ultimate test. I think that was a young man's view and a young man's romance with combat and what it would mean and what it could mean. But now I'm a father, and that will be my test, is whether or not I'm a good father and what kind of fathering I do to my daughter, what kind of husband I am. Those are the tests and the ones that that I want to pass day to day. And I had that realization. It landed on me with a lot of clarity, a true epiphanous moment on the day that my daughter was born, and she was sitting on my chest, and she was this new life and this new reality for me, and I experienced this psychological lightness, like so many anxieties about being a writer, you know, being a son, whatever else I was in the world, just kind of disappeared. And I thought, well, this is it. I'm a father now, and the most important thing that I'll do is father this little girl. And I welcomed that clarity, and I love now having that clarity and that meaning, which is, now my life's work. Mm.
This new book, again, is called Hotels, Hospitals, and Jails, a memoir published by 12 Books and written by Anthony Swofford. Anthony Swofford, thank you for writing this really powerful, unforgettable book. And I so appreciate the opportunity to speak with you about it today. Thank you.
Thanks for your time, Greg. Thank you very much.